Welcome to Your Family's Health. This is Dr. Janine Cook-Gerard, and I'm with Professor Joan Buckley. Hi, Joan.
Hello.
From the Nursing Department here at Nassau Community College. Your Family's Health is a program that focuses on health care issues and resources available here in Nassau County. On this show, we'll be speaking to experts from around the country to keep you up to date on current health care issues and trends. Today, we will be speaking to Dr. Michael Setson about the need for an ear, nose, and throat surgeon physician. So if you want to know more about how to stay healthy in Nassau County, stay tuned for the next half hour to the voice of Nassau Community College, 90.3 WHPC. Welcome to the show, Dr. Michael Setson.
Hi.
Welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, which means obviously I take care of the ear, nose, and throat. My main areas of interest include the nose, the sinuses, snoring, sleep apnea, acid reflux, and I do rhinoplasties, and I'm sure all of those things we'll discuss during this next half hour.
Yes, and I also know that you are in private practice here in Great Neck also.
Yes, I'm in private practice in Great Neck. I am a clinical assistant professor of otolaryngology at Weill Cornell University College of Medicine. I have been the past president of the American Rhinologic Society and the past chairman of the Board of Governors of the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. So I have been pretty involved in ear, nose, and throat issues nationwide and worldwide.
You know, this seems to be the perfect season for you. I know with allergies and our summer seems to have carried a lot of it into the summer months where it used to be like a spring thing. But do you see that in your practice that people complain of, say, sinus headaches or congestion more in certain times of the year than other times of the year?
You know, it is interesting. Initially, we thought it was somewhat seasonal, but Now I do see it all year round where people come in with nasal congestion, facial pain, and headache. And what's interesting about the sinus headache, patients think that if they have pain in the region of the sinuses, it's always due to sinusitis. But what's interesting, it's not always sinus disease that's causing it. It may be other things like migraine or temporomandibular joint dysfunction. And that's why the ear, nose, and throat specialist plays a significant role in letting the patient know whether this sinus headache is due to the sinuses or not.
So how is it that you differentiate when a patient comes into your office to determine whether it is allergic reaction or whether it is something that is different? How do you make that determination how to treat?
Sure. So what happens is if the patient comes in with nasal congestion, facial pain, that's usually less than about 10 days, more than likely it's just an upper respiratory tract infection. If it continues beyond 10 days, the virus usually becomes bacterial, and then it could be acute sinusitis. So I let patients know that if it's beyond 10 days, it may be the sinuses. If it's less than 10 days, it may be a virus. Now, if they have nasal congestion that may be seasonal, they'll have itchy nose, runny eyes, itchy eyes, then it may be allergic rhinitis. But generally, that 10-day period is the thing that's critical. Less than 10 days, it's an upper respiratory tract infection. Beyond 10 days, it may be a sinus infection.
Do you find that the people see their primary care physician first and try the less than 10-day approach with just maybe some antihistamines or something like that over the counter? Or do they come directly to you if they've had a history of problems with the sinuses?
Usually they'll go to their internist, primary care doc, or their pediatrician. But if it's something that's recurring, they get these infections, say, every couple of months, then they may come to an otolaryngologist or ear, nose, and throat doctor like myself. But initially, they will go to their primary care doctor, and they'll treat them not with an antibiotic if it's less than 10 days. We try not to give the antibiotic. They'll give them a decongestant,
Right. Something
in the nose like Afrin or neosinephrine, an antihistamine. You want to hold the antibiotic if it's bacterial. You don't want to abuse the antibiotics.
That is so important. I mean, with all the resistant organisms that we see now.
So when is surgery actually indicated for nasal congestion?
So what happens is you know, first of all, we want to decide, is the sinus headache due to the nose or is it migraine? So what we'll do is we'll take a history, nasal congestion, post-nasal drip, facial pain, longer than 10 days, then it's an acute infection. If it's longer than 3 months, it becomes chronic sinusitis. And those are the cases we generally operate on. Those patients that have had the problem in excess of 3 months that have failed optimal medical therapy, which may be a cortisone nasal spray, an antihistamine, a decongestant, and antibiotics. So if they've failed medical therapy, which is the first line of treatment, then we'll go to surgery. And the surgery usually entails something called endoscopic sinus surgery. We use little telescopes to make little openings into the sinuses. We generally enlarge these sinus openings so the sinuses can drain better, they can ventilate better, they can aerate better. We can get into the sinuses down the road if ever they get a problem. It's a very functional operation. It's a safe operation. It's usually done in an operating room under general anesthesia. Patients have anywhere from 3 to 5 days of discomfort. They may not be able to go to work for those 3 to 5 days. And then generally we can help them with a success rate in excess of about 85%. The patients that we have most difficulty with are those that have significant nasal allergies. Now the problem with those patients is, in spite of the fact that we did the surgery, they still may need to use an antihistamine and a cortisone nasal spray long term. But now the medication will be able to get into those sinuses and it'll work a lot better than before we do the surgery, because generally it doesn't get into the sinuses, so it doesn't help them, and that's why they needed the surgery.
So with this endoscopic sinus surgery, how long is the relief? So you're talking about a long term, a year, or is it just months that the patients can anticipate relief from their congestion?
So generally it's long-term relief, in excess of 7 years in 85% of the cases. So this may be long-term. Now, also, when we do the surgery, the patient may have a deviated septum, or they may have swollen inferior turbinates. Those are the little membranes on the inside of the nose due to allergy. And what we'll do is, at the time that we're doing the endoscopic sinus surgery for the sinuses, we'll address the deviated septum and address the swollen inferior turbinates. So we'll do something called a septoplasty for the deviated septum, and we'll shrink the inferior turbinates for the allergic manifestation of the problem. And those two additions to the endoscopic sinus surgery will help him with respect to nasal congestion.
Now, you spoke about your patients, obviously, both adult and children. Now, with children, do you see that they're coming maybe more after the 10-day period, because kids kind of are resilient and they kind of just ignore a lot of things until it's like almost to the point where the parent sees a difference? Because I just know sometimes kids, they don't complain. You expect them to have a runny nose or whatever, or, you know, the swimming changes their voice sometimes if they've been breathing in too much water. Do you see children as being a real challenge in treating sinusitis, or even just, you know, evaluating this congestion and that's lasted more than 2 weeks?
Well, that's a good question, because the average young child, you know, under 12 and definitely under 8 will have adenoidal problems. So those kids that come in with a runny nose, their problem may be due to big adenoids. Mm-hmm. And what we find is they may get sinus infections, but we rarely have to operate and do endoscopic sinus surgery on these young children. So evaluating them, obviously we take a history, nasal congestion, runny nose. Then we put a little telescope into the nose and we can see the big adenoids. And if indeed they have big adenoids, we will first treat them again medically with decongestants, antihistamine sprays, maybe even an antibiotic. And if that doesn't improve the big adenoids and the sinus problem, those children may just need an adenoidectomy, which is also an outpatient procedure under general anesthesia. It takes about 10 to 15 minutes. It's a rather simple, safe procedure, and it gives them tremendous relief because it improves their nasal congestion, it improves their runny nose, and it can help their sinus problems. If that doesn't do the job and 3 months later they're still having sinus problems, then yes, we may have to do very minor procedures on the sinuses to improve the drainage of those sinuses. But those cases are very few and far between.
Wow. You're giving me the chills.
Yeah, what are your thoughts? I've had some sinus congestion from time to time, and I've always been steered away from the over-counter nasal sprays because of the addictive, they have some addictive qualities to them. What are your thoughts about those?
No, that's absolutely correct. When I say nasal sprays, the two sprays that we recommend are saline nasal sprays and cortisone nasal sprays.
Okay.
We rarely give the decongestant nasal sprays, which vasoconstrict the inside of the nose, like an Afrin or norepinephrine, for more than 3 to 5 days at an absolute maximum.
Okay.
Those patients that are using those sprays long-term do become addicted to them. The nose swells up because now they need it, and every time they shrink the nose down, it swells up more. So we discourage those patients from using the decongestive vasoconstrictor nasal sprays.
Okay.
Rather, saline. Saline is actually the best thing for the nose, in particular children. The cortisone sprays in kids, you know, we want to give it for a short period of time. Adults as well, you know, don't give it too long. And don't give cortisone sprays to adults that have narrow-angle glaucoma. That's the only time we get concerned about the cortisone sprays. Other than that, the cortisone sprays are safe.
Wow. You know, it's a little early, but I think this is a good time for a break because we have a lot of things to talk about when we get back. So you're listening to Your Family's Health and the Voice of Nassau Community College at 90.3 WHPC. This is Joan Buckley, and we have Janine Cook-Garrod, and we have Dr. Michael Setson here. And we're going to continue talking about what's involved in an ear, nose, and throat exam or evaluation after this short break.
Let's go inside the mind of a 10-year-old.
I should have worn those earrings today. I like those earrings. Gabby has those awesome earrings. I need to ask her where she got those, but that's just what she would want me to do. I'll have Michaela ask her for me.
Buckle up, Sarah.
Yeah, but then Michaela will be like, why don't you just ask her yourself? That's just like Michaela.
Sarah, buckle up.
Michaela's such a great name. I wish I was called Michaela. There's like a dozen Sarahs in my class.
Hey, we're not hitting the road until you buckle up, honey.
Oh yeah, seatbelt. I forget sometimes because my brain is like busy, you know? I wonder if there's pizza at school today.
Sometimes it can be tough to get through to your kids, but it's not impossible. Always make sure they're wearing their seatbelts, even on short drives. Remember, you have the keys, you have the power. Never give up until they buckle up. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council. Visit safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup for more information.
WHPC.
Welcome back to Your Family's Health. This is Dr. Janine Cook-Gerard, and I'm with Professor Joan Buckley. And we welcome back our guest, Dr. Michael Setson. Hi, Dr. Setson.
Hi.
We're back, and we just picking up from where we left off, talking a little bit about ear, nose, and throat surgery and some of the care that goes into treating patients that have sinus headaches or sinusitis. We'll just talk a little bit about people who are concerned with getting a nose job, and this may be cosmetic, or it can be from any kind of medical, maybe a deviated septum you're talking about. How do you examine somebody, and how do you determine whether it is indicated for someone that has a deviated septum or wants to come in for a cosmetic change in their nose?
What we generally do, obviously, the first thing is we'll take a history from the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have nasal congestion? Do you have post-nasal drip? Are you getting attacks of sinusitis with facial pain and headache? Have you tried medical therapy? If indeed they say medical therapy hasn't done the job, I'm still congested. And then we say to them, you know, also, are you happy with the appearance of the nose? And many of those patients are coming in because they're a little afraid to say they don't really like their nose. And at that point, they'll say, you know, doc, I do have nasal congestion, but I also dislike the little bump on my nose. And while you're, you know, taking care of me to make me breathe better, can you help me with respect to the outside and make me look better? So when we think of rhinoplasty, we always think of it as two parts, function and form. We don't only want to make the nose look better, we want to make it work better. Because one of the worst things that patients complain about after a rhinoplasty is, doc, you know what, my nose looks good, but I can't breathe well. So we always think about the inside and the outside, making them both better. So how do we know that there's something going on the inside? We usually can look in with a little speculum, or better, we can pass in a little telescope, which is something with a little light on the end, and it allows us to evaluate the septum in its entirety. It's usually about 3 inches long. We can look at those things called the inferior turbinates, which are due to swelling, due to allergy. We can see what the sinuses are looking like. We can look at the adenoids. So we can evaluate the interior of the nose and let the patient know you have a deviated septum, swollen membranes, and while we're doing your rhinoplasty, we're going to fix that as well. Then we discuss the outside of the nose, and it's always important to find out from the patient, what do you dislike on the outside of the nose? It doesn't matter what I like or dislike. I ask them, what do they like? Well, they don't like the little bump on their nose. They don't like the tip of their nose. It's a little bulbous and swollen. It's a little longer than they want. So we first discuss what they like and dislike, and then I tell them what I think are some of the other issues that may need to be addressed, and then we discuss with them how we're going to help them. We'll do the operation. Post-operatively, they'll usually be a little congested. They may be a little bruised externally when they have the rhinoplasty. If they don't have a rhinoplasty and they just have the inside work done for a septum and or the sinuses, there's no facial swelling or bruising. The bruising only comes when we're doing a rhinoplasty because we need to move the nasal bones to realign the nose.
Now, when you examine a patient when they come in and they may not be happy with their nose, but is there a good, like, can you look at a person's nose and say or anticipate what their real problems are going to be? Or is some, I mean, if a nose is, you know, has a bump, it doesn't necessarily mean it's not working properly.
No. So that's why, you know, the history is important.
Yeah.
Are you congested? Then we like to look in the nose with a speculum or little telescope.
Yeah.
So that I can tell them the reason you're not breathing well is you have a bump on the outside of the nose. They may have a twisted nose on the outside where the nose is deviated to one side. I can tell them then most probably have a deviated septum, but it's critical that we look on the inside. Sometimes we even want to do an x-ray of the nose, and the best x-ray of the nose is called a CAT scan, not a regular sinus x-ray, but a CAT scan. But we only do the CAT scan usually if they're having facial pain, headaches, or sinus problems. We don't need to do it if they're going to get a rhinoplasty or if they have a deviated septum, more if they're having sinus problems. And many a times we can do sinus surgery at the time that we're doing the rhinoplasty and septoplasty. A lot of patients don't realize that you can do all of that in one sitting under general anesthesia as an outpatient and send them home an hour or two after that surgery.
Another area that you treat is snoring. And I know a lot of patients that have experienced sleep apnea experience the snoring. What do you do for patients who do a lot of snoring?
So once again, you know, ask the patient, you know, do you snore? Yes. Do you stop breathing when you're asleep? Has someone witnessed that? And if they do stop breathing, that's usually sleep apnea. And many of these patients with snoring may, in fact, have sleep apnea. So if you do snore, it's worth seeing your ear, nose, and throat doctor so they can evaluate you, look on the inside of the nose, see if you have a deviated septum. We also look at the inside of your mouth. Do you have big tonsils? Do you have a long, swollen uvula, that little thing that hangs down the back of the throat? Because the deviated septum, the uvula, and the tonsils may be the cause for your sleep apnea. So we'll take a history, we'll examine them, we send them for a sleep study. A sleep study evaluates how they're doing at night. It determines whether they're snoring, whether they have sleep apnea, whether they stop breathing for a period of many seconds, what's the oxygen level during the apnea when they stop breathing. So this lets us know whether they have more than just snoring, because snoring is somewhat of a social problem. Is it indeed apnea? And then we decide, is the apnea mild, moderate, or severe? If it's moderate or severe, it needs something more than just treating the nose. They may need something where they put a little bite block in the mouth to hold the tongue forward. They may even need something called a CPAP machine, which a lot of young patients don't like because they've got to put this machine over their nose. It looks like they're on a ventilator at night. Their spouses don't like it. They hate it, and they're going to use it for the rest of their life. But those are the ways that we treat it, either the bite block, the CPAP, or if they don't want that or they've failed that treatment, we can offer them a procedure to help their deviated septum, to remove their tonsils, and to trim that little uvula at the back of their throat. The problem with that surgery in the throat, the tonsils and or the uvula, is it is very uncomfortable for about 7 to 10 days.
Wow.
What do you think about the, it's over-the-counter, these, those strips that goes on the nose,
easy.
The breathing, yeah, the
yeah,
Breathe
Easy
strips.
Easy, but yeah, the strips.
No, the Breathe Right strips are very good, because what they do is they do pull the sidewalls of the nose away. That's why football players many a time are using it. But it's very temporary, and they need to use it every night. Right. Those patients usually have something going on the inside of the nose. But if that works for them, that's fine. If they don't want to do the surgery on the inside, use the Breathe Right strips. But generally, those patients ultimately will come to needing something. Either they have what's called alar valve collapse or deviated septum. And we can address those issues for them, unfortunately, with a surgical procedure if need be.
Now, who's on your team that helps present this to the patient in a way that makes it very, not appealing, because nobody really wants to have surgery, but makes it a little bit more palatable? Like, how could you explain, we're just going to stick a small scope up your nose, or, you know, and look, it just sounds to me, and having worked in an ER for a very long time and seen a lot of ENT procedures that are done emergently, I've just always wanted people to stay away from my nose. But who's with you? Is there anybody else on the team in the office that kind of helps with the psychological piece?
You know, it's interesting. Some people do have it. I actually find that it's best if I am there. Sometimes one of my office assistants will help me. But generally, it's me that does it. I say to the patient, I'm going to spray in a little decongestant in your nose. I'm going to spray a little local anesthetic. So what I'm going to do is going to be comfortable. All I'm going to do is pass in a tiny little light into your nose. It's not going to hurt, and it will allow me to evaluate the interior of the nose. Yeah. Having done this for 25 plus years, I've never had a patient say, Doc, I'm really concerned about it. They're more concerned when we go further down behind the nose and evaluate the larynx, because those patients may gag. But just looking in the nose is a very simple thing. Now, in children, obviously, they don't like that. So many a time, what we'll do is we'll just use our little otoscope, because they're used to the otoscope going in the ear, and that little otoscope will allow us to look into the child's nose, and that's usually not a problem.
You know, it's a trust issue, too, and I kind of like the idea of not talking to a lot of people about something where I need to totally trust the person that's going to be doing the evaluation. So I kind of understand exactly where you're coming from. I think that works for me. Right. But the children issue, I don't think I would want to work in your office. I'm sorry. I can't even imagine.
Do you see mostly children, or is it adults?
No. I see primarily adults. I am a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which allows me to see and work on kids. But the bulk of my practice is adults, but I do see children as well.
And for these sinusitises, do you see that it is mostly linked to allergies? Because
there's a significant proportion of the patients, in excess of about 30% of the patients, will have allergy. So what allergy does is it swells up those membranes in the nose called the turbinates. Okay. It swells up the sinus openings. It may cause nasal polyps. So the management of the allergy patient is critical, in particular before we operate on these people, because we may be able to help them without surgery. Right. And as I've said, even if we do operate on them, they still need allergy management to continue after the surgery. And I engage an allergist as well to work with me. So many of the patients, before I'm going to operate on them, I like an allergist to do the allergy testing. I don't do that. I usually have an allergist do it. Sometimes they need skin testing. They may need management of the allergy in conjunction with what I'm doing medically for them and surgically.
Is there ever a connection, and I think I know the answer to this, but having an expert right here is so nice. Is there a connection with the sinuses then, which you are an expert on, and the ears?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, many of the patients that have sinus problems also have eustachian tube blockage. And what's interesting now is we have a little balloon that we can pass into the eustachian tube and enlarge the eustachian tubes to improve their eustachian tube issue. And the eustachian tube discomfort causes pain, blockage. Sometimes they get fluid buildup. Every time they fly or scuba dive, it becomes an issue. And these little balloons have become a huge aspect of what we actually use to treat sinus patients. Sometimes we can actually, in the office, dilate their sinuses and prevent them from having to go to the operating room and having this endoscopic sinus procedure. We numb them up in the office. We pass these little balloons in, inflate the balloon for about 10 seconds in the involved sinus, take it out, and lo and behold, we can help these patients with a simple office-based procedure in those patients with the more minor sinus problems.
You know, my husband is probably a perfect example of every single thing we've talked about, and he's gone as far as having like tubes put in his ear as an adult, and recently he's had this issue. He blames it on a wide nose. He blames it on his mother. Of course, we blame everything on our genetics. But is it common for someone to have more than one issue? And he definitely ends up with the ear, the congestion and the fluid in his ears. And his hearing loss has been pretty significant because of some of the, you know, the time frames. Like he tries to get it under the 10 days and then he ends up going to the ENT. Is it any of this attributed to hearing loss or loss of smell? Or is there any other losses from this kind of sinus issue? I mean, it's huge, and it's not really talked about that much unless it's bothering you.
That's interesting. Your husband is like so many people. One in every eight patients has either allergies, mm-hmm. sinus problems, eustachian tube problems. They may snore. They may have a little bit of sleep apnea. It's all due to things that are usually going on in the nose. May have a deviated septum, may have allergies if he's never been evaluated. His eustachian tube may be a little bit narrower than others. He builds up fluid. It affects his hearing. These are very, very common problems. And as you said, your husband does see an ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And these kind of patients definitely need to be evaluated by an ear, nose, and throat doctor, because so much goes on in the nose that causes these multiple problems: snoring, sleep apnea, nasal congestion, hearing problems, eustachian tube, sinus problems. They all go together. And just by looking in the nose with a little simple telescope and sometimes an x-ray like a CAT scan, we can evaluate the problem and treat it. And the good news is with these little balloons that we have today, we can offer the patient relatively simple, safe procedures, and we can help them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This interview has been so informative for me, even as a nurse practitioner. And I think for the audience, we're walking away with so much information on how we are to look at our congestion and the different surgeries and possibilities for treatment of nasal congestion. So we want to thank you, our guest, Dr. Setson, for being with us today. And we want to thank you, the listening audience, to Your Family's Health.
This brings an end to another edition of Your Family's Health. Joan Buckley and Janine Cook-Garrard are professors of nursing at Nassau Community College. Your comments are always welcome by emailing whpc@ncc.edu. This program was produced at the studios of 90.3 WHPC on the campus of Nassau Community College. Podcasts of the show are available on iTunes, Android Podcasts, and Spreaker.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Your Family's Health on the Voice of Nassau Community College, 90.3 WHPC.